The do's and don'ts of social media. Facebook, LinkedIn, Snapchat, and gulp, Twitter. For a generation born into the digital age, social media outlets are a critical link to friends, to trends, to the world. And businesses are finding that these kinds of media provide a cost-effective and quickly responsive means to communicate with clients and customers. For some of us, however, the world of social media can be daunting. We may have dipped our toes into the Facebook sea, only to find that we are over our heads. And there's no doubt that social media present their share of dangers and can quickly damage a personal or professional reputation and open one to cyber threats and abuse, or worse. So what to do? You could just stick with email or listen to this program. I'm Keith Shortall, and today we'll talk with a panel of experts who will help us learn more about social media, the risks and benefits, the do's and don'ts. Social Media 101, today on Maine Calling, First This News. From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. If you're anything like me, the first thing you did this morning was check your Facebook feed and then send out a few tweets, posted to Pinterest, checked your Instagram, then did a few Snapchats, and then updated your LinkedIn profile. Okay, truth be told, I did none of these things. And frankly, I'm not sure of the difference between Pinterest and Instagram, Google Plus and Google Hangouts. But I'm in luck today, and you're in luck today, because with us in our studio, some social media experts. They'll explain why social media matters to them, both from a business perspective and in their lives outside of the office. And maybe they'll teach me and you a thing or two about learning to love life online. With me in our studios, Kelsey Goldsmith. She's the owner and founder of Lovell and Paris PR. Alex Steed is a founding partner of the content firm Knack Factory. He also blogs about politics and culture for the Bangor Daily News. And John Ippolito is a professor of new media at the University of Maine, where he directs the Graduate Digital Curation Program. He's just published a book from MIT Press on preserving digital culture called Recollection. And of course, as always, we want to hear from you. Are you an inveterate Facebook user, or do you shun all things online? Our phone number is 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email address, talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, all of you, to Maine Calling. A lot to talk about today. And I'm a good host for this particular program because the most I would do is maybe get some Facebook Messenger notices on my phone and maybe read them later. So I'm not a big user, and we'll certainly take calls from people who are who use daily, who are addicted to the stuff, and others who may be a little afraid. Let's start with you, John Ippolito. Can we, in this modern world, is it a reasonable option to opt out of social media? Can you get along in life, or are you really going to just miss too much by not jumping in?
Well, I think you can get along pretty well. There's plenty of people in the world who don't have cell phones in their pockets and easy access to the technology we do, and many of them live happy lives. But in our fast-paced American society, it's a bit like getting along without a car. Cars are handy. They're also deadly. It's not just on car crashes, but spending too much time in a car, studies show, are bad for your health. And I think of social media that way. Just because you think that I need to access this periodically doesn't mean you need to be addicted to it and on your phone all the time.
Kelly Goldsmith, the news stories we often hear are always bad. It's always that somebody was stalked online, or someone's reputation exploded because they posted something on Facebook that they shouldn't have, or didn't quite understand what the rules of Facebook are. Are the dangers really that significant in your view, or do the benefits really outweigh them if you know a little bit about what you're doing?
You know, I think the benefits certainly outweigh the costs. And I think that it's interesting, as people get more and more comfortable with social media, they often forget that it is a very authentic form of communication, and they don't use the same caution or modesty that they might use in a real life interaction. And so that's something that I think folks need to keep in mind as they're communicating via any of these modalities. Something interesting, 25% of the folks who have a social media account check that social media account more than 5 times per day. So it's certainly not a stand-in for authentic communication, but it's much more fluid and much more fast-paced than that authentic communication that I was referring to. So folks just need to remember, instead of just wiping their fingers across the keyboard, that that there's a lot more going on there.
But Alex Stee, there are genuine issues, though, of privacy, and we've seen this around Facebook, which quietly changes what it's doing, and unless you're on top of it, you may not know where your information is going or even what you happen to be writing out may be going or who owns it or where it's stored. So there are legitimate issues around this that are complicated and that people should be aware of.
Sure, and there have been issues with all sorts of communication media. I mean, the elderly continue to face phone scams via the telephone. The Zodiac Killer sent his messages via traditional U.S. Post. There are dark sides to every communication medium, and that doesn't
dial M for murder.
precisely, and that that. There are these elements, but that also does not negate all the positive that comes from engaging accordingly.
John Ippolito, but is there a generational gap? Is it oversimplifying it to say, well, there are, you know, these millennials who were born into the digital age for whom these outlets are second nature, and there may be those who are my age and above are having to learn this sort of awkwardly? Is that part of the disconnect between the generations?
Well, sure. I think that if you look at each generation of people, you also have to match them with the generation of technology, right? So older folks now are kind of comfortable with email, but they can remember a time when that was a strange phenomenon. The historian Elizabeth Eisenstein talks about when this strange new technology came out in the Enlightenment period in Europe, when young people were using this new technology to access this medium that no one else could really understand, and it made multiplying information beyond control, so that it was hard to keep up on. And she was talking about the printing press and glasses. So, you know, we can look back and say, well, each generation has its own kind of technology that it's comfortable with and those that seem newfangled. But we can also be a little less knee-jerk about it and notice that, for example, seniors are really picking up on Facebook now, whereas they really weren't, in my experience, you know, 15, 20 years ago. So it's not just about each generation that comes along has its own medium, but some media sort of grow into a certain demographic.
And the benefits of Facebook, for example, for older folks who might not be able to see their grandkids as much, who might feel disconnected from their friend who lives 2 miles away and they can't drive and see each other. In a lot of ways, these social media can connect people who have felt isolated in some ways.
Well, oh, sorry. Please.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to chime in and say, actually, the users of Facebook who are growing the most exponentially are moms and those with young children at home. They are folks who are typically about 30 or 35 years old, and 75% of them have constant access to Facebook in particular. It's a way that they build relationships with other moms who may be home during the day with their children, and it's a great way for marketers to reach a large purchasing power demographic in the United States. So it's a really interesting trend where it's not just about sharing photos with grandparents and aunts anymore. It's really about building a social circle of folks who understand what phase of life you're in.
Let's move the conversation then to we'll focus on Facebook because it's the most familiar one to the most people listening right now. Among the decisions that you have to make, Alex Stead, if you're getting into the Facebook world, is with whom to become friends.
Sure.
There's a little bit of etiquette around this, I guess, or a decision to be made, and that is this for your immediate family and friends to share personal photographs and maybe information about where you're going to go? Say you're going to be away for the weekend. You don't want thousands of people to know that necessarily. So how do you make that decision about how many friends to choose and how you choose them?
Well, it's the same way I make almost any decision, which is I look at the action and say, why am I doing this and what do I expect to get from it? What will stand in my way in one way or another? There was a long time where I wouldn't connect with people who I was professionally related to, but as the nature of my job changed, that line between personal and professional became a lot more vague, so I connect with those people. There are issues, obviously, of privacy. There are issues that are important to consider if you have children and you're posting their pictures online. There are great conversations happening around that about what their rights to privacy are, even though they don't necessarily have a say in what you post about them. But you know, to talk off the last comment slightly, I recently was connected with a cousin that I didn't know that I had, and found old photographs that I scanned and then put online. And because of Facebook and because of these connections, I found photos of family members that she'd never seen or never knew that she had. So they're really interesting, also, you know, genealogical gains that can happen just from people being passively associated on this digital network.
John Ippolito, some people may measure their success in life by the number of Facebook friends they have. There seem to be friend collectors in this business. But isn't it also true that the more people that are following you, that you're connected to, the more you might be an instigator or creator of memes or other things? In other words, there's a benefit to being heard by so many people.
There is. I mean, in the sort of circles of network theory, this is called the strength of weak ties, right? So Facebook, the last I checked, had a limit of 5,000 friends. So it's not like you could just keep collecting them ad nauseum, although sometimes when I go on Facebook, nauseum is the right term for how I feel. In fact, there's a sort of claim by sociologists that you can never have more than 150 real friends. And that's obviously a, you know, kind of fuzzy number. But that doesn't discount the possibility that engaging in any of these social networks, Twitter, Facebook, and so forth, especially the ones with larger reach, will connect you to someone that you didn't know had some important resource, knowledge, connection that you could use. And so the idea of the strength of weak ties is that, yeah, if you always chat with your own friends, you're going to have a sort of inbred conversation. But every once in a while, you'll reach someone who can tap into some part of the world or part of the globe that you didn't know about and you needed.
And Kelsey Goldsmith, for businesses, I'm thinking the other day I wanted to know what time this restaurant opened. Now, I could call and leave a message and they could call me back, but I just went on Facebook and I messaged them. I said, hey, I got an instant reply. So I could check the menu there without going to a website, you know. So it was very easy for businesses, particularly small businesses. Facebook is also really a sort of a cheap web presence that's also very reactive. You can respond quickly to customers.
Absolutely. And you can also convey your particular business's personality and help folks connect with the business that way. So if the restaurant you were going to dinner at, you know, had a Facebook photo of some very fancy seafood dish with lots of garnish and you name it, you would have known to dress a bit differently, right, if you were showing up there. So it's a really great way to subtly communicate with folks about their expectations and the personality of a business as well.
And you can instantly share that site or whatever with your friends pretty easily.
Absolutely.
But Alex Steeda, there's a certain point, a certain scale at which then businesses, though, have to monitor that voice they use on Facebook, for example. You can't have one person on one shift, you know, sort of being sarcastic and flip and hip, and then another one being very conservative, depending upon what time you check in on that business. So you have to have a plan around who's going to be the voice of your Facebook or Twitter feeds.
Right. I've seen not just one, but several businesses either get in trouble or fold because of how they interacted on social media. It's if you don't have a plan and you don't do it in a concerted way, it can be problematic. It doesn't have to be. In theory, it can be a very sort of low impact, low overhead approach to the way that you communicate with a consumer base. But the larger your business or community in general, but the larger your business or larger your operation, it has to be concerted to some degree, but also without being too controlling. I mean, that's the interesting balance.
Sure. And I'm sure we'll have more questions and thoughts about Facebook as we take calls after the break. But I want to run through some of the other social media and kind of compare them. And John, you forwarded a link to a chart that I think was really interesting, which was a quick glance at social media, who the clientele happen to be, the users tend to be, and the strengths and weaknesses. But let's go to our next friend, Twitter, which we also read a lot about, though. I'm not sure it's on this. I'm not sure it's. Oh, yeah, there it is. Twitter tends to be used by urban, educated, famous,
and nerdy, or that's the descriptor. So would you all agree that that's accurate?
It's pretty good.
NPR.
NPR, public, yeah, PR.
These are very subjective.
Sure, of course. And it's a chart, but it's handy, and we will post it on our Facebook page as well. Strengths of Twitter: fast, broad reach, easily shared, nearly real time. Weaknesses: short, easily spammed, can be frivolous and ephemeral. Johnny Pulido, how describe your take on Twitter and where it stands now in the landscape of social media outlets. Is it a rising star or fading star?
Well, I think it's if you look at like the up to the moment sort of analysis, it's fading in the sense that so many other social networks are kind of creeping up, whereas it was Facebook and Twitter kind of, you know, were the big two for a while in terms of the kind of communications social media, but it's still very powerful because it does have that it's sort of its weakness is its strength, right? 140 characters is all you got, so it makes it easy to scan global headlines and pass on something that you just took a few moments to look at. And that kind of virality, I think, is still stronger than the virality of any other social media that I know of. So we're talking about, you know, maybe only 25% of adult internet users use Twitter. But of those, you know, that's a 25% of people for whom big impacts can be made in the world.
It's a great way to sort of monitor news, which we do here, to send news as it's happening, to reach people on their phone and say, hey, this just happened. And obviously a great way for celebrities to, you know, do whatever it is, whatever messaging they want to get out to the people that adore them.
Well, it helps, and it also helps form narratives that otherwise didn't or couldn't exist in mainstream media. I mean, for example, I learned about the initial Ferguson riots because people, activists on Twitter, were bringing that to the attention of the mainstream media, particularly trying to bring it to the attention of CNN, which was covering something ridiculous on that day. And it wasn't until it was over, the attention was grabbed by a bunch of people on Twitter asking why they weren't covering the siege of a town in the Midwest.
We'll talk about some of the other networks that are less used, but are quite popular in different demographics. We also want to hear from you. The number to join the conversation, as always, is 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
If you have something to say, you say it. Are you lying to them? Are you lying?
No.
On the next Fresh Air, Benito Martinez, who co-stars in American Crime, the new ABC TV series, and John Ridley, creator and executive producer. The show set in Modesto, California, after a home invasion and murder, seen from the perspective of suspects, victims, and their families. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. You're not alone in listening and supporting MPBN Radio. And if you're also on Facebook, join over 18,000 other listeners who are now friends of MPBN. We promise not to bombard you with stuff, but we do share special programming and event news and try to answer any questions you might have about our radio, television, or online services. And we often have questions and want information from you. So do join us. It's a great way to connect with other listeners and viewers. If you like MPBN On Air, like us on Facebook too.
You realize how many people have read this? I'm up to 2,000 followers since last night.
You're trending, bro.
They're sending me messages. They're goading me into responding.
Don't do that.
Don't do it, man. Don't respond. Take the high road. Respond.
I know, but half the people are saying he's right.
Yeah, but half the people are saying he's wrong. That's the internet, bro.
That's right. Listen to him.
That's social media.
Hey, what are you doing? Don't do it. What are you writing?
Chef, don't. That's not a good idea.
Just listen. I won't send it until we all say it's okay. Why don't you come by again tonight? I got a whole new menu just for you, Ed.
No.
That's not good.
Give me the phone. Give me the phone.
Don't do it. That's out there now, bro.
It happens.
Why would you do that?
You can't take that back.
You know what? I threw down the gauntlet.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. You just heard a clip from the movie, the 2014 movie Chef. And in many ways, it encapsulates some of the Wild West-like atmosphere of social media. Today here in the program, we're talking all things social media. With me in our studio, Alex Steed. He blogs about politics and culture for the Bangor Daily News. He's also a founding partner of the content firm Knack Factory. Kelsey Goldsmith is owner and founder of Lovell and Paris PR, and John Ippolito is a professor of new media at the University of Maine, where he directs the Graduate Digital Curation Program. He's just published a book from MIT Press on preserving digital culture called Recollection. We invite you to join the conversation. Call us at 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Comment on Facebook coming up in just a second here. Kay is in Portland and is on the phone, but I wanted to run through a couple of the other networks that are popularly used that we may not know a lot about. LinkedIn, I think I've heard of because it's middle-aged and educated, I think is the descriptor from our chart here. But it's like a professional kind of sharing thing. John Ippolito, explain what it is. I'm getting requests all the time.
It's basically for people looking for a job to be perfectly blunt, and it references your employment history, your skills. You can give testimonials to other people. It's the kind of thing that teenagers look at and go, like, why would anyone contribute to that? But, you know, a few years down the road when they're trying to get advancement, they might be interested.
Yeah. Snapchat, popular among teens. You're not a Snapchat user. Alex Steed, what can you tell us about Snapchat? And is it one of these things that's popular for younger folks but may not be used much elsewhere?
I read a column for BDN last week that ended with the line, can somebody please explain Snapchat to me? there is a rationale. It sort of is a messaging service that captures sort of the fleeting nature of photography and communications. And interestingly, news agencies are actually starting to use it in order to connect with new audiences. But it's one of many new approaches.
John, here, I would just say that the best way to understand why people use Snapchat, especially younger people, is to think about the bad side of Facebook, right? Facebook's mined by the NSA. It's converted into private information that then sold to companies. People can get ejected from their schools or jobs from what they post on Facebook. And Snapchat auto-deletes after a certain number of seconds of watching. So it is, in effect, the anti-Facebook.
Pinterest, anyone?
Well, I'm renovating my house right now, so Pinterest is at the top of my list. It's a great way to use visual libraries to figure out what may be appealing and of interest to you, so you can share it with friends and family. There's a great new company called Stitch Fix as well, not social media related, except that they're online stylists, and they use your Pinterest account to figure out what kind of clothing might be appropriate for you based on the other visual images you've chosen to add to your Pinterest boards.
According to our comparison chart, the stereotypical demographic for Pinterest is rural, white, and female.
Well, I fit two of those three categories. So.
Yeah, I think 1 in 4 American women use Pinterest who use the internet regularly, which is an astonishing figure.
Right. And I promise we'll go to Kay. But so which network do you think is on the rise out to be among it, maybe the next in the big three? Any idea?
So I think one network we haven't chatted about yet today that is certainly on the rise is Instagram. It's certainly edging out Facebook in terms of popularity. And really, it's a photo sharing social media site. So it's a great way for folks to capture one image, one still from what they're doing either at work or with their family and share it with a network. You can share through your Facebook and Twitter and other networks as well. So it's powerful in that way.
But don't worry about Zuckerberg. They own Instagram. So he's not.
So he's hedged.
He's secure.
I see. We're worried about him. All right.
Yeah, we were all worried.
I was so concerned.
All right. Let's go to Kay in Portland. Hi, Kay. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thank you for having me. My experience with Facebook is interesting in the sense that I am always trying to deactivate and stay deactivated because I find it to be a place where sensitive types like myself have a hard time. It can be kind of ego-driven in terms of relationships. And it came to the point where I felt the constant drive to confess was not, in fact, liberating, but privacy itself became liberating to me. Mm-hmm. The retention of privacy and having my own world and my own private friendships was more important than constantly feeling like I needed to confess everything. And I think a lot of people are finding that to be the case nowadays.
Kay, I'm curious, did anyone, when you said, I'm not on Facebook anymore, say, oh, you know, what happened? Or what are you trying to hide? Or,
Yeah. It's a constant. It's almost as though when I deactivate it, it's become this major concern for people in my life. Like, what happened? Are you okay? Do you want to have coffee? You know, like it's something so monumental that shouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. John Ippolito.
Kay, I'm there with you. And I consider myself a relatively thick-skinned person. But the fact that these people then said, hey, you know, maybe we should find out why you're not on Facebook. Let's have coffee. I think that was a total win for you. It doesn't mean that, you know, everyone needs to abandon Facebook or everyone has the same experience as you. But I don't think you should by any means feel like any one of these social media is a necessary, evil that you just have to stomach. I go to Facebook a couple times a year and I'd use it as a sort of purely broadcast medium where I don't put anything private. Just the way I tend to use it.
And when I met my wife, she was not on Facebook and she's still not on Facebook. And I found that to be the most exotic thing that I'd met in a woman, seen in a woman in a while. And I got to know this woman, not sort of through passive social media, which was amazing. I can't believe I'm going to get an opportunity to name drop Michel Foucault right now. But Foucault's whole approach to the idea of how we form identities around sexuality in particular is about this idea of our compulsion to confess and that power is held with the people who pull the confession out of people and especially consumers. So Kay, you're right on to be skeptical. People have been critical about this this compulsion for quite a long time, and I'm sure you found some liberation in walking away.
Kay, what about have you considered Twitter or some of the other networks that.
I find Twitter to be horribly confusing, and the idea that I have to just completely bring my entire idea down to I forget how many characters is horrifying to me. So I couldn't do it.
All right. Well, maybe in the course of the show we'll come across one that might help you. Thank you for joining us. Also, we had Eric who couldn't stay on the line, but he said he still doesn't understand what Twitter is, even after listening to our guests. And then another question, can you explain what Twitter is? Who would like to tackle that? It's kind of straightforward. We'll let Kelsey do it.
Twitter is a way for folks to share information. It has to be 140 characters. So you compose a message, whether it is about what you're doing that day or usually more realistically about a news story or an idea that has caught your attention, and you tweet that composition. So it is seen by anyone who follows you, and you see what your followers are tweeting or what the folks you follow are tweeting. So it's a great way to figure out sort of what's at the top of the landscape. I pretty much every morning, oftentimes before I've even gotten out of bed, just thumb through Twitter to see what's going on. So I follow everything from, you know, MPBN to the New York Times to lots of friends and family to figure out what news stories, what new ideas are sort of at the top of their mind that particular day.
And then if you were an opinion shaper or a taste maker or whatever these words are, then you could use Twitter for people who follow you to then share what you think about that or what you think about that, what she's wearing on the red carpet dress or that sort of a thing. So it's a unlike Facebook where you're sort of just sharing with all of your friends, this is a very much, right, John Ippolito, it's like a I'm somebody and I'm going to tell you what's happening or respond to what's happening kind of.
Well, there are certainly ways that it's used that way. I tend to be less interested in what celebrities and politicians have to say than, you know, the underdogs or the average person might come out with a thought that then goes viral in a way that maybe, you know, is only previously available to people in power who have a microphone.
But that has to be can you explain retweeting then? Because
sure.
That's a decision that one makes in a way that to spread information.
Right. So if you think about the way that the web was before social media, you had people would write plenty of interesting things on websites and so forth, and you had to go find them. Even with blogs, which are a form of writing that's more obviously longer than tweets, people could register their opinions. But there wasn't a really easy way to then send that virally on to other people, like a single button that would do that. And the what people have now in terms of Pinterest and pins, Facebooks and likes, and in the case of Twitter, retweeting is just a single click that says, I think this is cool. I think more people should see it. Boom, I'm sending it out to all my network.
Likes is another thing, another decision that we often make. Sometimes when you're on Facebook and you see you have so many posts to respond to and you don't have a chance to say, congratulations, Phyllis, or whatever, or she looks really cute. You just hit the like and that means you saw it and you approve and you're happy.
And from a business perspective, that also means Facebook gets to collect as much data about your preferences as possible and then sell you advertising accordingly. So that's the other side and sort of the business side of Facebook and social media in general is that your behaviors on social media form a profile about the sort of person and really ultimately the sort of consumer you are, and they become an advertising medium or advertising platform.
Right. All right. Let's go to Bob in South China, and I assume that's South China, Maine, Bob.
That is South China, Maine, where it's still cold, though.
Yeah, I bet.
Glad to be here. This is a great show. One of the things I'm concerned about was with LinkedIn. They wanted to share my whole contact list, so I kind of left them aside. But it kind of brings up this bigger issue of having a kind of a public persona, stuff that you love to have the world know about. But there are also some of the private things with family or in certain subgroups that you have, certain clients and all, that, you know, you don't want them to know that. And it seems like this is a very tricky area to know who sees what. Not that I'm trying to have a split personality, but it's kind of like, you know, there's a really public part. And then I have some maybe things out on the edge that I'm exploring, but, you know, I don't need the world to know that. That kind of thing.
Sure.
So I'd love to get your insights on that.
So, right. So can you have a, you know, Bob Incorporated presence on most social media and a private Bob without making it look are there rules against that?
There aren't necessarily rules, but I associate there being cultures with each of the networks. And I've seen people describe before that Twitter's like a party. Twitter's sort of like either a party of your interests or a party of your profession. And Facebook is like a family party. And the way you conduct yourself is different in both of the places. I spread the blog entries and the columns that I write for BDN via Twitter. And, you know, today, for example, I shared a very personal story on my blog that I shared only on Twitter and not on Facebook because I didn't necessarily want to have the conversation that would inevitably have happened on Facebook by sharing it there. So I put it on Twitter where I know there's a different readership and that it'll get attention in a different way. These are all decisions. These are all sort of interaction by interaction decisions that that one makes when engaging accordingly.
And Bob, I'll just chime in with a little bit more advice, which is explore the privacy settings on each of your social media accounts. There are some really great opportunities for you to perhaps share a little tidbit of your LinkedIn profile, but not the whole thing without someone having connected with you first, similar to Facebook, where it's very possible that you could only there's a way to set up your account so that you're only asking people to connect and not soliciting incoming connections, et cetera. So explore some of that and see if that might make it sit a little better for you.
All right. Good luck, Bob. And we'll look for you. On LinkedIn. Well, at least they will. I won't be. But anyway, we're going to take another short break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. The number again, 1-800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566 for those of you that have a phone still. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by Casella, dedicated to improving air quality for all Mainers through a commitment to reduce its carbon footprint. Casella, giving resources new life.
Morning Edition is awake around the clock to bring you the latest news.
It's 2:10 in the morning, so still 5 hours left.
The hosts are usually here around 3:30.
You have Ophibia at 4, and it's about the Boko Haram ISIS news over the weekend.
Crunch time is 4 a.m.
Until 5 when the show starts.
Hit it. Open.
Good morning, I'm David Green. With
Morning Edition, up all night to bring you all you need to know. Listen tomorrow.
And you can tune in to Morning Edition tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. And tune in at 1 o'clock following Maine Calling for Speaking in Maine. We'll head to Waterville and Colby College for a talk by Jamila Biggio, former White House Director for Human Rights and Gender. Biggio will reflect on her work to promote equal rights and opportunities for women and LGBT people around the world. That's Speaking in Maine, the speaker Jamila Biggio, this afternoon at 1 o'clock. Here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, knowing the difference between Instagram and Pinterest, Snapchat from Chat Roulette. With us today, John Ippolito. He's a professor of new media at the University of Maine. Alex Steed is a founding partner of the content firm Knack Factory. And Kelsey Goldsmith is the owner and founder of Lovell and Paris PR. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call. The number 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to David in South Portland in a moment, but from the Twitter, strategies for small businesses to overcome the Facebook policy of limiting views of page posts unless we pay. An abbreviated question, but I guess Facebook has limits on how much you can get for free. Is any advice for getting around that?
I would say in general, Facebook advice for businesses is to ensure that you are being liked by the right demographic of people so that the folks who are seeing your page posts are the people who are important to you. So that's really the first step in the game. So it may not be as important, for instance, that your mother and grandmother and aunt and uncle like your business Facebook page, but that your actual customers like your Facebook page. And that way, again, you're limiting it to the folks who really matter. Obviously, there are other interesting things. You could post a link, as an example, to your website and share information there and drive people to your website as opposed to actually sharing the information on Facebook. And you can also pay for advertising. The list goes on and on. And I think both Alex and I have businesses that help folks strategize around that. So certainly we would both welcome a follow-up conversation.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go to David in South Portland as promised. Hi, David.
Hi. Yeah. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to comment that when I first joined Facebook, it was a tremendous opportunity for me to connect with people who, like you said earlier, are far away or distant. But a lot of the friends and then the comments that I saw on Facebook was rather interesting. I saw people making comments that they wouldn't normally make face-to-face, you know, where social conventions would hold them back. And I saw a lot of sometimes hurtful and mean statements on Facebook. And it just struck me as kind of odd that this was like almost a wall that people could hide behind, even though they're not really hiding because their name's right there. But they say some things that are somewhat maybe even inappropriate.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if someone could comment on that.
Yeah, is there a phenomenon whereby people are braver or more foolish or, you know, in these sort of digital worlds? We've seen the recent story of the legislator from Northern Maine who's gotten in hot water for stuff that he's posted on Facebook, but which is stuff that he wouldn't say on the floor of the Senate, for example. But is there any research, Johnny Polito, about how people behave differently maybe when they're in this digital world as opposed to face-to-face?
Sure. I can't cite a study because I think people take it for granted that the more distant you are and in general the more anonymous you are, the more likely you are to be abusive. And that actually cuts both ways because, you know, one of the up-and-coming social media right now is Yik Yak, which is used in college campuses primarily. It's geofenced, so you know it's your local community. It's like being in a party with the lights off, and you can hear people talking, but you don't know who's saying something. So essentially, a college campus will all be able to communicate anonymously with each other, and the result is often very crude and rude talk. There's a certain level of harassment and so forth. But some people justify that by saying, well, what's actually happening is people are saying honestly what they feel. And so that kind of cloak of anonymity gives them the ability also to be a whistleblower or to say something about what they wouldn't normally say. Maybe they come out as someone who's lesbian or gay in a way that they wouldn't be able to in public, that kind of thing. So even at a remove where you can see people's names, but they're not next to you in a room when they're on Facebook, there is that double-edged sword.
And not only that phenomenon, which is the phenomenon of distance, but just that what we haven't really covered is the idea of social media just means media not used exclusively from a broadcast form. There's media through which you can interact with communities of other people who are interacting about something similar. The sheer number of conversations that we have generally about topics that we used to only touch on maybe once or twice a year, if ever, if at all, especially controversial topics, is through the roof compared to when I was 20, 11 years ago. It's because, someone will put up a link on Facebook about the Palestinians' right to a state. I mean, who was having conversations casually about the Palestinian statehood 11 years ago? Now that's a conversation we're all engaging in. It's going to be hot. It's going to be intense. Same for same-sex marriage. There are a number of issues now that have become part of our daily conversation strictly because we can have those conversations.
Let's go to John and Kennebunk. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hello.
So my ears really pricked up when your guest mentioned the French philosopher Michel Foucault and brought me back to my college days of semiotics and reading the philosophy. But then I was really disappointed that he didn't go to the work that really is relevant to this. I believe it's in the book Discipline and Punish, in which Foucault wrote about what he called the panopticon. And it was talking about a societal trend in which we're drifting towards a point where we can all see one another, and the effect that that has on the society. And I think that this is really the relevant thing when we're talking about social media. We're all exposed to one another if we choose to participate in this. The writer Cory Doctorow said Facebook is a Skinner box that teaches you to give up your privacy. But the relevant point to me about what Foucault wrote about is that there is an end to this. There's a reason why this exists, because there's an element of social control that happens when we can all see one another, and it affects people's behavior. And I feel like the conversation that we've been having about this is really focusing on the shiny object of being able to communicate with one another over social media and not the reasons why this exists. It was touched on very briefly, but Facebook is used to mine data about us, and it's used to target us as consumers, and that's really what's driving this. It's not some magical, miraculous thing that appeared out of nowhere. And I think we're dealing with it very superficially. It's almost like having a conversation in the 1950s about television without talking about advertising on television and how that dictates and informs the content of television. So I'm a little disappointed at this main public radio, because you guys are really the non-commercial venue, and I expect to go like a little deeper.
Well, John, we just had you on. I think that's why we have it as a call-in program, so that you can share your views, and maybe we could do it on social media as well. But I'll let John Ippolito respond.
Yeah, John, thank you for bringing that really important point up. The panopticon, just to clarify, was not where everyone can see each other, but where the prison guards can see the prisoners without them seeing back. And I think that really just speaks to your point that Facebook's admin, as well as the the commercial interests who they sell your data to, as well as the NSA and other government agencies who have literally a hardwire into the servers where they can mine that data, are all sucking your information that you choose to put there. That is why I don't put private information on Facebook. On the other hand, as you mentioned, public radio does offer, and public television, an alternative to the commerce-driven model of most media monopolies today. And there are alternatives to commerce-driven social media. People aren't as familiar with them because they're not as well known, some cases not as convenient, But things like the Tor network, Freenet, Diaspora, there are a number of projects that allow completely private conversations written with open source software that do not have a commercial interest behind them. And I'm a user of many of those networks.
Right. So is it? Let's ask John. John, do you use any social media yourself, or do you use it just very carefully?
I do not use it at all.
At all, for this reason, the same reason that you're sharing here.
Exactly. Yeah. I place a high premium on my privacy from those kinds of people. I'm actually a very public person, very, very engaged in politics municipally and even statewide.
I'm curious, John, if you have had the experience of seeing the benefit of social media when used specifically for political activism.
Well, as I'd say the benefit is when it's used actually as a broadcast medium. So it's not really being harnessed for its non-broadcast aspects.
I can understand that. On the other hand, I've also spoken to people who've lived through the Arab Spring in Tunisia and Egypt, and they've described how, in addition to that kind of broadcast propaganda format, they did use Facebook for simple things like finding out where the fighting was going on so they could hide in each other's houses and escape shelling. So I think there is also a kind of a many-to-many dynamic, as Alex mentioned, of grouping together to help better yourself and your community.
Now, there would be no law against simply creating another sort of form of Facebook or Twitter, which was solely intended to share information for the good and not meant to make money. But would people use it? I mean, the whole trick is to get people to jump in and embrace it. I'm sure it has been tried.
Well, I think, one of the contrasts is I sometimes think about we're in this alternative universe where, Facebook went commercial, but Wikipedia is not, right? Wikipedia has got a staff of like 50 people and it has no commercial basis whatsoever. It's a nonprofit running on open source software. And you can imagine the reverse. You can imagine a world in which Facebook was this open source nonprofit world, but the place we all went for encyclopedic information was this commercial place that mined everything we were looking for. So I don't think there's anything necessary about the world that says that Facebook has to be a commercial platform.
All right, let's go to Shannon in Bangor. Hi, Shannon.
Hi.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's going well. We're about 5 minutes from the end. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to make mention in this information age that I'm just concerned. I know there are lots of benefits with social media that do tend to seem to outweigh our privacy and stuff, but just I wanted to make mention, in light of the John Bapp teacher who just committed suicide after requesting nude photos from a student. I just wanted to remind people that, privacy really, really is an important thing here, and people, like that other woman said, sometimes you tend to feel obligated to confess and to be open about everything, and now somebody's lost a father, somebody's lost a husband, a teacher has committed suicide. Just a major tragedy has come out of something where I'm sure the people involved thought that it was just some kind of covert behind your computer screen thing, and just every little click of your mouse can have such a huge impact. And just wanted to remind the young people to be careful who they're communicating with and what they're posting out there.
Sure, and I mean this is an entire other program is about safety and particularly among children and teenagers and those who are really into this but can get burned by it in some significant ways. We could spend another hour on that. We have in the past, and we probably will in the future. But let's just end there with a little, maybe quickly, if you want to get in, you want to maybe expand your use of these, what's the best advice, John Hippolyto? Protecting yourself and your privacy.
Oh, I see. Think before you click. As one of your callers, Bob, who was talking about this sort of screen that popped up and said, import all my contents into LinkedIn. No company ever lost money by getting more data from you. So their design, their literal interfaces are meant to lure you into giving up more and more.
As John pointed out, this is its reason to be. Right. So if you keep that in mind, if that's front of mind, then then you'll do better or well. Yeah, Kelsey.
Well, to Alex's analogy from earlier in the show about being at a family party or being at a salon session, sharing ideas with friends, you know, think about what things you would do in those environments and don't move beyond those bounds. So if it's not a conversation, you might start with your uncle or start with a college classmate or a coworker. Steer clear of that and make sure that you're conducting yourself on social media the same way that you conduct yourself on other media.
Yeah. Alex D?
Just very similar, very similar advice to what I said earlier, which is just echoes exactly what's been said here, which is be intentional about all of your actions. Same as offline advice. Same as you wouldn't pick up the phone to call a random person to start a fight. You know, use the tools for what they're for, and use them for what you're trying to for the means or purposes you're trying to achieve.
Kelsey, John, Alex, thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kelsey Goldsmith is owner and founder of Level in Paris, a public relations firm. John Ippolito is a professor of new media at the University of Maine, where he directs the Graduate Digital Curation Program. He's just published a book from MIT Press on preserving digital culture called Recollection. Alex Steed is a founding partner of the content firm Knack Factory. He also blogs about politics and culture for the Bangor Daily News. John Keimel ran the board today, and of course you can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. Our executive producer on Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a look inside a virtual charter school. We'll hear from the principal of Connections Academy, Maine's first virtual charter school, as well as from a parent of a Connections Academy student. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.